Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph, and we're today in lesson 216. And we're going to continue now with Exodus chapter 4 and verse 7. Last time we were discussing the teaching or the idea and the concept and the misunderstanding along with that of people when it comes to the name of God and what kind of name to use, how to pronounce it, matters like that. And in the process, people are boxing in God, and they are limiting Him, and they do not appreciate, you know, the full concept of God, that humanly speaking, to begin with all the names that He had given us, we cannot limit Him to this name or that name or the other name. And so when some people think that, you know, if we just say that name, then that's the right one. And as a matter of fact, that was also a major problem in the Jewish community, where they thought that you can basically more or less, one way or the other, pronounce any name of God, you know, the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Rock of Israel, Redeemer, Deliverer, and Savior, and so forth, or Elohim. But you can never say what they call the expressed name, which is Jehovah. A Jew would never pronounce that. And to this very day, they feel the same. And obviously, you know, it started because of abuse, but then it became a sort of a mystical thing that people believe in to this very day. And yet God never forbade that, and he never forbade any name. And when He says, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain," and so you think, well, now I'm not going to pronounce the name Jehovah, and therefore I'm okay, but I'll say all the other names. Well, that's what God meant. Any name that you call upon the name of God, you see, if you take it in vain, you've done it in vain. It doesn't make any difference what name you take in vain. And yet people, you know, invent their own doctrines, and they say, well, only this name, He meant that. Well, His name is what He is, and that's what He was explaining to Moses. And mind you, Moses, when he came to Egypt, and since that time, to this very day, you generally don't see that name ever mentioned here. You see, with the exception of Jesus Christ, who mentioned that very name again. And these are the only two places where you find it. And of course, in both cases, it was translated in English to I Am. But then nobody was speaking English in those days, so it's neither here nor there what it says in English. But the reality is that what God said, you know, the concept that He was trying to drive into the mind of Moses and to Israel, do not box me in. I'm not limited to this name or that name, you see. Every name that He calls Himself by what He does, that's what He is. And He cannot swear in the name of the Redeemer and say, well, you know, I didn't swear in vain because God says only His name, and His name is not the Redeemer, only that name, or this name, or the other name. And you see, this very, you know, to this very day, you know, this very attitude on the part of many when they, you know, they want to show that they know better than others, and they spell the name of God, you know, Yeshua, and some who know better, you know, they say Yehoshua, because you cannot say Yah in the beginning, either in Yahweh or Yeshua, you say Yehoshua. And so many say Yeshua, or Yeshua. You see, Yehoshua is actually the longer form. But in either case, I was just one of His names, the Savior. And when He came on this earth, most of the time they did not call Him Jesus, you know, in the Hebrew, Yeshua, or in Greek, Jesus later on. You see, most of the time they just referred to Him as the Master or the Lord. Very few times, you know, they called Him by that name, Jesus. And yet, now and then, some did. But all these names that God gave Him, and He's going to give Him many more. King of Kings, Lord of Lords. You know, Jehovah of Jehovah, that's what it means. Well, actually, Lord of Lords would not be Jehovah of Jehovah, but, you know, literally, Master of Masters, Lord of Lords. And the reality also, you know, even the other one, Jehovah of Jehovah, since those that He's bringing to glory are going to be sons of God and therefore gods, that means deities themselves, eternal beings, and eternal means Jehovah, so He's going to be also in that sense Jehovah of Jehovah. But still there is one above Him. And so anyway, let's continue now with verse 7, where now Moses is being told by God to do the second thing. In other words, first one was the snake and the second one was the leprosy. And then, this is what God is telling him about it. And he said, put your hand back into your bosom. And he put his hand back into his bosom. And when he took it out of his bosom, behold, it was turned again as his other flesh. And that's again one of the names of God, the God that heals. You see? And some people say, his name is Yahweh Rofika. Well, he didn't say that that's his name. Jehovah, that's his name, you know, the Eternal. And Rofika, you know, to begin with, you know, it's Rofecha, your healer. So, you know, it's not a name, it's what he does. You know, we have to understand the difference. What he does, he heals, and he kills. And he brings evil on his people. We can call him, you know, the God that brings evil on the sinners. And so forth. So he is described by what he does. And in that sense, you can say those are all his names, and he's got many. There's no limit to his names. Anything that he does, that's what he is. And to begin with, when God began his introduction to his word in dictating to Moses and revealing the name by which he wants to be called, you know, the first name that he revealed himself by was not Elohim. It's not in the beginning Elohim created. You see, but in Hebrew, in the beginning created Elohim, Bereshit Bara, which means created. So introduced himself first as a creator. That's his name. Anybody who swears by the name of the Creator, he swore in vain. If he had done it in vain, that is. And so, he's a healer also. And so this is what we see here. Only here, you know, just he made him in essence sick, and immediately he healed him, you know, for the purpose of that sign that he was going to show later on. And of course, later on, when Moses was going to do it, you know, calling upon God to go through the same again, God will in essence strike him with leprosy and strike his hand and then strike and then heal his hand. And this is what he does here. And so it was turned again as his other flesh. In verse 8, and it shall come to pass, if they will not believe you, neither hearken to the voice of the first sign, that they shall believe the voice of the latter sign. And Egypt, because of all the iniquities and sins and in uncleanness of many there, was stricken also. A lot of people were stricken with leprosy. So that's again another sign that God had chosen. You know, first he's chosen a God that they worshipped to show that he is in absolute charge of it. And then he showed the fact that he can heal all the sicknesses of Egypt. As he told later on his people in Exodus 31. He told his people that, you know, if you are going to obey my Sabbath, I will put none of those diseases, you know, all the diseases that were in Egypt upon you. And so that's another sign that he's using there to show that he is God and he's not limited to any one single thing. You see, the Egyptians would have gone to a certain God that, who is in charge of healing and to another God for something else. And that's why, you know, this is what explains to you. And, you know, that should become very clear in our minds. God is what he does, and that's his name. And we should not box him in into only one single name and, you know, one single description of him. You know, Yeshua, that's what it means. God the Savior. God that saves. That's a description. That's just an empty name. And so all these names are his. By whatever name we call him, you know, just like, you know, some people joke, you know, call me by, you know, whatever name you want to call me, just call me for dinner. Well, in essence, you know, the same concept with God. No matter what name you use for him, you see, as long as you have faith in him that he will deliver you, and you trust in him, he's going to respond. And so, this is what we read here. And in verse 8, he says, it shall come to pass, if they will not believe you, neither hearken to the voice of the first sign, they shall believe the voice of the latter sign. Verse 9, and it shall come to pass, if they will not believe even these two signs, neither hearken unto your voice. After all, you know, you're talking about people who have been rebel rousers for a long time, disobedient, in bitterness of bondage and spirit, hard-headed. And therefore, some people, you know, no matter what you do, you know, they still are not convinced. And so he's going to give him another one. And so that's what he says, you know, they don't listen to those two, and neither hearken to your voice, that you shall take off the water of the river, and now not only the God that is portrayed as a snake, that he shows that he is in charge of that, and also healing, and now he's going to go to the Nile, you know, in one way, you know, the life-giving of Egypt. And so it is an extremely important, if not the most important God that they had. The God of the Nile, without the Nile, in other words, they would all be dead because they would have no water to water their gardens, no food to eat. So it would be probably the most important, if, you know, if not the most important God. It could be at least one of the most important ones. And so he was going to show them again that he's also the God of the Nile. So any God that they had, which they called God of this and God of that, this is a true God who is really the God of all these things. And that's the reason why he says, whatever I'm going to do, this is what I am, you know, my description. And that's the name of God, the ultimate name of God. Anything that he can do, all-knowing, all-powerful, you see, and so forth. And so this is what he's saying here. You shall take of the water of the river and pour it upon the dry land, and the water which you take out of the river shall become blood upon the dry land. And Moses said unto the Lord, O Lord, I am not a man of words, neither heretofore nor since ye have spoken unto your servant. And to God does make any difference. You see, a lot of people like to come, you know, with their great oratory skills, and therefore they convince people, and people are convinced because of that. They say, oh, what a great orator. And as Paul said, you know, he's just like Moses. You know, he was not a man of great words. He was not a great orator. And people said that his speech was contemptible. In other words, they forget. It's a message. It's not the words that people use, you know, their capacity to speak eloquently. Now, all the speakers who are much more eloquently than others, you see, and there are always others who do not even believe in God at all and despise God and have even much greater skills and abilities. So what does that mean? It has nothing to do with our abilities to speak. It is not by power. It is not by might of men. It is not by any skill that we have. Now, that's what Paul is saying. We didn't come to you, you know, with a you know, great swelling, you know, speeches of men and oration and things like that, but by the power of God. And that's what Moses here, you know, is not comprehending that. You know, he's trying to get out of that job because he realizes what kind of Israelites he's going to face. He already had an experience with them. And this is what he said to God. You know, I'm a man of a slow speech and of slow tongue. And the Lord said unto him, who has made men's mouth? And who makes a man dumb, or deaf, or seeing, or blind? In other words, you just forgot what I just told you, that I am Ehyeh. I can do anything. So what do you worry about? That's what he's saying here. So God is a God that gives eyesight. God is a God that gives the ability to speak. And he gives you the hearing and everything else. So he's already beginning to limit God right there on the spot by throwing this poor excuses. When he just told him that I am, you see, what I am. In other words, Ehyeh, Asher Ehyeh, whatever. I'm going to do this is what I am. So why are you limiting, you know, me? And this is exactly what he's doing here. So that's what he reminds him. Who made men's mouth? And who makes a man dumb? Or deaf, or seeing, or blind? God is the one that is responsible for it, either causing it or allowing it. And he can also alter that and change that, because that's the kind of a God he is. He can do anything. And so that's what his name, you know, is the most more inclusive one. You can say in one sense, Ehyeh is the most inclusive name of God. You see, all the others are limited. You know, you say eternal. And eternal, well, the holy angels that he created now, though they were not in existence for eternity, but from the moment that he created them, now they are eternal. You see? And so that eternal, there, you know, that just tells you that you are ever living, but, you know, you may be ever living, but not too powerful or too knowledgeable and things like that. But Ehyeh means whatever I'm going to do. You see? That's all inclusive. Anything that God does and can do and is able to do, that's what he is. That's his description. In other words, in simple words, he has no description, ultimately speaking, because nothing in human language can describe him totally and ultimately. But at least, you know, that's in human language, that's the most inclusive name that he has. Ehyeh, I will be what I will be. And in essence, you might say also, that includes also the past and the present. And so God says in verse 12, now therefore go. In other words, stop bubbling here and I just go do what I told you to do. And I will be with your mouth and teach you that what you shall speak. And he said, O Lord, send, I pray you, by the hand of him whom you will send. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And he said, now it doesn't mean, you know, when the anger of the Lord is kindled against you, that he's going to smite you. No, that's a human reaction. You see? And most people, you know, would just, you know, if they just read that statement and nothing beyond that, they would have thought, well, now he's going to kill him. That's not what it means. You know, a lot of people don't know the real God that we serve, or the God that is, whether we serve him or not. And they think that's the natural reaction. He's a man of wrath. He's a God of wrath. And that's how the way a lot of people look at the God of Israel. Well, he was angry at him because of his obstinance and stubbornness and unwillingness to accept the fact that God can do everything. And therefore, if he can do everything, what is it that we have, you know, to resist it or to say, no, we cannot do it? Well, all things are possible with him. Well, there is nothing impossible for him because he is a here. Because he can do whatever he can, you know, he can do. You see, and he will do whatever he wants to do. How can we limit him? And this is what Moses was doing here. First he's limiting himself, now he's limiting God. And he's saying, you know, send somebody else, I can't do it. And so the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. And so obviously, Aaron was already in a position where he was doing a lot of preaching, one way or the other. So, in essence, you know, he's revealing here something that we don't read in the account. But Moses and Aaron, and, you know, the Levites, are already, you know, were distinguished as a tribe who were going to serve God from the beginning of time. So, obviously, he was known to be as a good speaker. And so he said, you know, what's the problem? You know, he can't talk, he'll talk for you. And so he says, I know that he can speak well. Behold, he comes forth to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. So God is already orchestrating every detail, and he's already speaking to Aaron, and he's telling him, you know, you take off from, you know, from Egypt, and go in, and see your brother. So he said, you know, I've arranged everything. You know, I told you, yeah, Asher, yeah, I will do what I will do. You see, I will be what I will be. I will accomplish what I will accomplish. Don't ever limit me, and let not Israel limit me to any single role or name. So, Moses continued to do it because, again, that's a hardness of heart in essence when you think about it there. And oftentimes we do just the same. No matter how much God tells us He's going to be with us, we still find all kind of excuses why it's not going to happen. And, you know, that's faithless. And verse 15, he says, and you shall speak unto him, and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth, and with his mouth, you see, I'll be with both of you. In other words, what you're going to say is not going to be man-made, it's not going to be of your own words, so you don't need to worry about it. Whatever God is going to speak through his prophets, through the servants that he sends, it's going to be directly from him. A lot of people, you know, who are striving very hard to be great orators, what they mean by that, they are the ones who are going to speak those big swelling words and impress people with that. And people say, oh, what a great orator that person is. And we have that example, you know, of King Herod, not the great Herod, but his son. When he gave a great oration, you read about it in the book of Acts. And all the people said, oh, whoa, you know, this is the voice of God. You know, this is the, you know, that's the oration from God. And he took the credit to himself, and he was a great speaker. And immediately, you know, God let him know what he thought about it. He sent an angel to smite him, you know, with a worm, and just he just died. He dropped dead. Now, this is the ideal concept of drop dead, and he dropped dead. God is not impressed with a great oration. If he is not the one speaking, if it is not his words, he's just not impressed with the words of men. You know, and the grammar and all that. And those who know Hebrew know very well that when you go to the prophets, grammar was not their strong point. And if it was, they did not use it. Because many times they use a lot of verbs there in the past that, you know, they meant to say in the future, and the present they meant to say in the past. And words, you know, they were just all sentences cut in the middle. Or words that were not even finished. And yet God was the one that was using them and speaking through them with whatever limitations they had. Many of them were more educated than others. That didn't make any difference to God. If the words came from Him, that's all that counts. You know, let's take note of that, because there are a lot of us who are impressed with the great orators of the land. And there are those in our midst that people are flocking to them because they have a much greater ability to speak. And it's that they go for, not the words of God. That's idol worship. And so this is what he's saying to him, you know, I'm going to put those very things in his mouth and in your mouth, and he shall be your spokesman unto the people. That means the words I'm going to put in his mouth will make him your spokesman. It's not that he's going to be on his own because of his great ability to speak. And it shall come to pass that he shall be to you a mouth, and you shall be to him in God's stead. In other words, you shall be to him like Elohim, as if, because God was going to speak directly to Moses, and Moses is going to convey it to Aaron, and then Aaron will use his speaking abilities to convey the words of God. But if God is not in it, you know, the speaking ability is neither here nor there. And so he said in verse 17, and you shall take in your hand your rod, wherewith you shall do the signs. And there is nothing mystical about the rod. You see, a lot of people like to worship things, you know, like to worship the cross, to hang it around their neck, and all kind of things like that. Or some people like to parade with a picture of their founder, or their leader, whatever it may be, and so forth. Those are idol worshippers. And they forget God. And it's only God that we are to worship, never a man. As the holy angels, you know, told the servants of God now and then, like in the book of John, where you see John, he was so impressed, but all that the angel told him, he just totally forgot himself and all that he had known, and he prostrated himself before the angel to worship. And the angel rebuked him. You know, you stand up. I'm just servant just like you are. You worship God, never a man. And unfortunately, an awful lot of us, you know, for a long time have been taught to worship a man, and many people are still doing that to this very day. And their faith is in men, or in the body, you know, they call the church. Every group, you know, thinks they are the true church, or some of them think they are the true ones. And people put their faith and trust in that, not in God. And so that's what God is conveying here. So he said, you take the rod, but mind you, if God doesn't do anything with the rod, nothing's going to happen. And Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law. And Jethro is also Reuel, the shepherd of God. So shepherd of God means his spiritual title, so to speak. In other words, he's a servant of God, of the flock that were in his under his jurisdiction, so to speak. And of the Midianites that were there. All children of Abraham, still retaining good measure of the faith and what the teachings that Father Abraham gave them, you know, mixing it with whatever they've added to it. And he said unto him, let me go to his father, I pray you. Now, he doesn't come as a haughty, arrogant man. Hey, I just saw God and I'm going to take off. Well, you know, what do you say? It's neither here nor there. I don't care about you. You see? That's what God said later on about Moses. He's the meekest man. So he comes now and he's pleading with his father-in-law, let me go, I pray you, and return unto my brethren that are in Egypt. And God, you know, that's a spirit of humility, that no matter what a man is, you know, through whom God is going to do whatever, even if the man, person to person, met God, spoke to him, it doesn't exalt him above others, you see, and doesn't abase others just because of that. And that's one of the greatest pitfalls of leaders. As soon as they have, you know, they feel that God has inspired them, or they've been given a measure of truth or authority, whatever it may be, immediately they begin to exalt themselves and personify the office, and that's to their own destruction. God is not a respecter of persons, and so you see the humility continues, and that's a genuine person, servant of God. You remain a servant. And that's what he says, let me go, I pray you, and return unto my brethren that are in Egypt, and see whether there be yet alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. And the Lord said unto Moses in Midian, so now he speaks to him, go return into Egypt. So it was in the land of Midian. In other words, the Midianites had lived there, but you know, Midianites were not there. That was not the only place where they lived. They lived in several areas. There were tribes, several tribes of Midian, so each tribe lived in a different area for obvious purposes. You cannot all be together. Isn't enough for your flocks. But that particular one lived there. And later on, Ishmael, well, actually the descendants of Ishmael, not Ishmael, Ishmael was before that, they lived in the proximity there of Midian, and so they got mixed up with them. At least, you know, they traded with them, worked with them, probably had some intermarriages among them. Today they're all known as Arabs. And interesting that when you go to the Quran, you know, for I think that's a good book to read, because there you find out the mind of the Arab, why are they what they are. And there Muhammad speaks about the Midianites, that he was not too pleased with them because they seemed to be a little bit feisty. Of course, he himself was feisty. This Midianites had lived in this area and many other areas. He goes, and from there he returns to Egypt. And so God tells him, while he's in the land of Midian, go return unto Egypt for all the men who are dead that sought your life. So it's not only Pharaoh that sought his life, it's people around Pharaoh, and obviously the family of the man that he killed. You know, was a high official, high Egyptian official apparently. And so a lot of people, you know, wanted to seek his life, and who knows how many other people, even among his own people, that didn't like what he was telling them, they too wanted to get rid of him. So God in essence says, you know, they're all gone, nobody's around anymore. And Moses took his wife and his sons and set them upon an ass, and he returned to the land of Egypt. Now his wife was a Midianite, means also a daughter of Abraham from Keturah. And some people in their confusion think, well, she, you know, she was a Cushite, because later on it talks about Moses marrying a Cushite, well, that means a black woman from Ethiopia. And this one was not a black woman, this one was a Midianite, and Midianites were white people. You know, they were children of Abraham and Keturah, and all of them came from Babylon, and they were white, and they were not black. And so they confuse the two women, and they think that when it says that Moses married the Ethiopian, they talk about Zipporah, and that was another woman that he had there. And he took his wife, Zipporah, and his two sons, Gershom and Menashe, and he returned to the land of Egypt, and Moses took the rod of God in his hand. Now it becomes the rod of God. Even though it used to be his rod, you know, he used to use it as a shepherd, and that became the rod of God because God was going to use it, and that rod ended up later on in the tabernacle, one of the holy items, sacred items, because God used it for that purpose. And, you know, in the foolishness of people, you know, they began to worship that and worship everything else that God created. In other words, the usual, people worship the creation more than the Creator. And we are doing it to this very day one way or the other. People worship the work. People, you know, worship this or that, and men, and teachings. And the Lord said unto Moses, when you go back into Egypt, see that you do before Pharaoh all the wonders which I have put in your hand, but I will harden his heart, and he will not let the people go. You know, you might think at this point Moses says, you know, what's the use of going to him? Well, God already made it very plain, the reason for all that. He wanted to show before all of Egypt and before all of his people Israel that he is the Ehyeh, the one that can do anything and everything and is not limited to any capacity as all their gods were. So people would know he is the ultimate, really the one that does everything and has the capacity over subjugate all their gods under him and all their demons that they worshipped. And he's in absolute charge. That's the reason why he gave, you know, one of the laws there, you shall have no other Elohim before me. I am the only Elohim that is dealing with you. He did not say, I am the only Elohim, period. But I am the only one that deals with you, and the only one that is on this earth, you see, and the only one they are going to come in contact with, you know, until later on he came and revealed the Father, the one who is even higher than him. And to begin with, that revelation was already there. And so the people of Israel understood, you know, that concept. And only later on, you know, the knowledge began to disappear from their minds and hearts. And yet some still kept it to the day of Jesus Christ, like Nathanael and many others. They still knew that they are two. Even the rabbis, a lot of them knew that. And so verse 22, he says, and you shall say unto Pharaoh, thus says the Eternal, you know, Jehovah, Israel is, was, will be. And some people thought that, you know, Israel was just his son, and then he gave him up, you know, and he got tired of him because of all of his problems. And now he says, I'm going to get me another son. Doesn't work like that. And both religions have done it. A great whore and all those that came from that And to this very day they do it. And there are a lot in our midst who believe the same lie, that Israel is no longer God's son. Now we are the son of God. And now we are the church of God. We are the people of God. And also the other false religion that sprang in the Middle East, they too advance that same concept. Oh yeah, in the past Israel used to be the people of God, the son of God, but now we are the one. And see, and they even replaced the second, that is the Christianity, that claimed the same thing. And so if somebody else comes, you know, later on and does all those exploits that Muhammad did in terms of war and bloodshed, you know, he's going to claim the same thing too. Well, that's the nature of men. But God says, Israel is my son, my firstborn. And after Israel, there are going to be all the other brothers, all the nations of the earth. But Israel was, is, and will always remain the firstborn, and will always have the preeminence. You see, it's out of Israel that the wife will come, and the wife will be Israel. That is all the repentant among Israel, and God said very plainly through Paul, all Israel shall be saved, you know, obviously with the exception of the incorrigibles. And so Israel will remain always the firstborn, just like Jesus Christ will always be the firstborn of many brethren. You see, he will never lose that title, and Israel will never lose that either. And so God sworn by his own name, by the mere fact that he's the creator of heaven and earth, and he said if the moon and the stars and all those things are all gone, you see, then Israel is going to be rejected. But since they are not, Israel will never be rejected. It's an eternal truth that has been rejected even by many who are ignorant in our own midst, you know, who believe the same lies of the whore and that of Islam. But Israel, because of his rebellion, was replaced. Only God can do that, just like he had done, you know, with Reuben and Joseph. He took it from the firstborn and he gave it to the secondborn, his firstborn, which was Joseph, and he was a firstborn. And then he took it from the firstborn of Ishmael and he had given it to the firstborn Isaac. And he'd taken it from the firstborn Esau and he gave it to the firstborn Jacob. But he'd never done that with Israel. Never done that, never will. That was one of the major lies that began to be preached 2,000 years ago, and the apostles were combating that very lie. That was a part of the mystery of iniquity, and many of us are still in it when we make those kind of statements. You know, Israel was God's people until Christ came, and then once he died, then they were no longer his people, now we are his people. Where did we get this lie? You know, our true father did not tell us that, but the false father did. Verse 23, and he said, I have said unto you, let my son go. And that statement he always made to every ruler and every evil dictator that he himself may have raised and have raised against his own people to afflict them, take them into captivity. But then he will tell them, let my son go. And so he's going to say also in the future, when he's going to crush, you know, that horde of armies and enemies of Israel that will come around Jerusalem, he's going to blot them out from under heaven, and the few of them that will be left, he's going to tell them, as you read in the prophets in Isaiah, go around the world and bring my sons back. Let my son go. You see? There's never been any change to that. And all of the liars, you know, that speak otherwise, and unfortunately in ignorance, a lot of people are liars without even realizing it. Because, you know, they're just like Peter said, you know, there are a lot of people that do not understand the scriptures of Paul, the writings of Paul, and a lot of people don't understand the writings of the prophets, and all the men of God and God himself. And so they're wrestling with the scriptures to their own destruction, and many are still doing it to this very day. Well, when God speaks, he's not a liar. Many's, as Paul would say, let every man be a liar, but, you know, God only speaks truth. And so he said, let my son go that he may serve me. And if you refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay your son, your firstborn. And it came to pass, on the way at the lodging place, that the Lord met him, met Moses, and sought to kill him. And of course, God did not choose at this point to fully amplify exactly what was happening here. But in essence, there was a problem here that we discussed before that. And Moses had two sons. The first one was circumcised. The second one, for whatever reason, you know, was not circumcised. We don't know exactly why. And yet God, if he's going to use a servant of his, that servant must be obedient to the law of God. And one of the major laws that were given to Israel was that if you are to be a part of the covenant of Abraham, you must be circumcised, and God is not playing games with that. And again, we've got a lot of liars even in our own midst that have totally lost knowledge and understanding, and they say, well, you know, yes, I know I'm an Israelite, but, well, that was only until the day of Christ, and after that, you know, I don't need to do it. You know, because of the false misunderstanding of the circumcision issue in Acts 15. Well, the man would always use anything that he wants to do away with the law of God. Especially the ones, obviously, whose parents haven't done it, you know, they're adults, they're not interested in doing it. And so they have to find, you know, this excuse. And here it is, what God thought about it with Moses, his very servant, whom he just commissioned to be as God unto Aaron, you see? And yet God is not a respecter of persons. So he wanted to kill him. And some think, well, maybe that means about the son of Moses, and not Moses himself. And so we read here, the Lord sought, met him and sought to kill him. And it doesn't say his son, it said him. He's dealing with him, speaking to him, you know. His son is not even in the picture. Only now he comes into the picture. And then verse 25, then Zipporah took a flint and cut off the foreskin of her son. She had to do it because Moses, that was his responsibility. It's the man of the house that does that. And a lot of things, according to the law of God, it's the man of the house that does all those things, not religious leaders. They've taken that authority to themselves, and circumcision became one of them. And weddings, and funerals, and many other things. The things that God had given to the head of the family. And so, she had to do it, and cast it at his feet, and said, surely a bridegroom of blood you are unto me. And obviously, you know, she is not an expert, she doesn't know how to do it properly, and so there's a lot of blood there, and she's very shocked by it. And so she's blaming Moses for not doing his job. And then we're in verse 26. Once that was done, we read about God, so he, God, let him alone, you know, let Moses alone. So some people think, well, he was stricken by a horrible disease, whatever it may be, was ill, so he couldn't do it, and Zipporah was forced to do it, knowing what was a problem. And maybe he told her to do it since he couldn't do it. Then she said, a bridegroom of blood in regard of the circumcision. So she was putting the guilt on him, and obviously that was a problem. Well, some rabbis that look into that, knowing the customs of the time, traditions of the past, and known fact that when God called Abraham, he told him to circumcise, you see, when he gave him that covenant of circumcision, his firstborn at the time when he spoke to him was already 13, while Abraham himself was 99. And his son, Isaac, that was born later on, you know, he was 8 days, and he told him, when your son is 8 days old, that's when you circumcise him, and from now on, that's the date to choose for circumcision. So that became the law in Israel. When they were 8 days old, that's when they circumcised them. And so the rabbis think that what happened here, since he was with the shepherd of Midian, also a son of Abraham, but maybe influenced by what happened to Ishmael when he was circumcised at 13, and may have kept that tradition of circumcising at 13th, as the Arabs do to this very day. And therefore, Moses was influenced by that, and he may have postponed it to that age. After all, you know, his father-in-law is still in charge, and, you know, whatever it may be, he was compromising with the law, and maybe with the first one also, circumcised at 13, but then he was already grown up. Well, this one was not circumcised yet. He was not 13 yet. So Moses is going to Egypt now with an uncircumcised child, and here's a man that is going to tell Pharaoh that if you do not obey the will of God, you're going to have dire consequences, and yet he himself is in transgression. His own son is not circumcised according to the law. Well, anyway, that's the way they explain it, whichever is the case. And so they feel that God struck him with an illness, that is Moses, and he was disabled, and therefore Zipporah was left to do that. And so she's putting the guilt on him because of that. And obviously, God is not going beyond this point. He's not discovering more details. You know, he's not interested in humiliating Moses. And so he basically gave us this, and in sort of a vague way, but obviously people at the time knew what was happening. And so
She puts the blame on him, and he was to blame. He should have been obedient to God and follow the law regardless of what his father-in-law told him. If that was the case, that he waited until he was 13 because of what his father did, or, you know, his wife also. You know, that was their custom, age 13. And so, anyway, that was done, and so God now tells, he speaks to Moses in verse 27, and the Lord said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. And that's what he does. And he went and met him in the mountain of God. That is in Mount Horeb. So he walked all the way there. And obviously, it was not too far. When Israel came out of Egypt, it took them 3 days to get... When Moses was commissioned to tell Pharaoh that his people are going to go to worship God, he says, you know, we'll go 3 day journey. Well, perhaps even if you just walk fast, it takes 3 days. But obviously, when you have a whole nation with floods and all that, it takes much longer. And so it could have been just 3 day journey from Egypt, from Goshen, where Aaron was. And he went over there and he kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord wherewith he had sent him and all the signs wherewith he had charged him. And Moses and Aaron went. Now they are on their commission on the way back to Egypt. And the first thing they do, they gather together all the elders of the children of Israel. Again, they could do it, and there was a freedom of movement, and freedom of speech, a lot of those things. You know, Pharaoh was not interested in suppressing many of these things, and they were not in the, as we mentioned earlier, they were not in the concept of captivity that we have when we look, for example, to the concentration camps of Nazi Germany. That was a totally different kind of captivity and exile that Israel went through later on. And in this case also we see that they lived in their own towns, they lived in their own cities, they had cattle, they had riches, they had even servants that were Egyptians. And all that was not altered, generally speaking, to one degree or the other, maybe to a degree, but not totally. And he could go there and just get all the elders of Israel and gather them together and speak to them. And so we see also later on in Ezekiel, he did the same thing. When God gave him a message, he went and gathered all the elders of Israel that were in that place, supposedly in captivity. In our concept, you know, they were in such a place where they could not go here or could not go there. And therefore, we say that Ezekiel could not deliver his message. That's because we do not really understand the book. We never read it properly. We injected our own concepts, false concepts, into it. Anyway, in verse 30, and Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken unto Moses and did the signs in the sight of the people. And so Aaron now becomes the chief spokesman, and Moses stands next to him. But all of them know that Moses is the one in charge, but Aaron becomes his spokesman. And in those days it was pretty common, you know, the king had his own spokesman to do the speaking for him and also the writing. So that was not totally uncommon for them. That in essence shows you not who is the chief, but shows you at that time it's not the speaker, but the one who is standing right next to him. He's the one in charge. He's sort of the king. And verse 31, and the people believed, that is the elders of Israel, but we're talking about the elders, we're talking about mature people. And they themselves, obviously, they're old people, they're not there in the mud pile, you see, in the mud pit. They are in their own homes, and therefore they can be called. And they are men of faith, at least much more faith than the rest of the people that were in the mud pit because of bondage. But these people were not in bondage. So they could come and go and do this and do that. You know, they could go to the king of Egypt, they could walk into his palace, you see. So it's not the false concept that we find in the minds of men. And verse 31, and the people believed, and when they heard that the Lord had remembered the children of Israel, and that he had seen their affliction, and then they bowed their heads and worshipped. You know, they bowed their hands to the ground and worshipped God. And so these are not people of ignorance, and they know it. And obviously, you know, a lot of the people that were told this same thing, you know, they also believed, and especially when all the signs were done in their sight, and they saw all these things, and they had faith. What they didn't realize, that's just the beginning. That's not going to be the end. And so they gave up the faith as time went by, and they were not delivered, and even turned against Moses and Aaron. Then we see in chapter 5, and afterward Moses and Aaron came and said unto Pharaoh. So first they went to the elders of Israel, and Then they took the elders of Israel with them, and they went to Aaron and Moses. That is, Aaron and Moses went to Pharaoh, and they said that to him. Thus says the Eternal, Jehovah, the deity of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast unto me in the wilderness. Well, that's not the real commission. The real commission is, you know, just let them go, and we're going to go, and that's it. Never, you know, just bye-bye, never see you again. But he's not saying everything. And a lot of people, you know, if they function based on misunderstanding of black and white, or say, well, he was not telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, therefore he was lying. Well, those who are wise and understand the law of God and the spirit of the law, they understand. You know, there are times where you do not have to tell the whole thing and still not be a liar. You've got to be shrewd as a serpent, harmless as a dove. You know, the circumstances will dictate that. But generally, as a human being, as an honest human being, when you're called upon, you know, for matters that require, you know, the totality of truth, otherwise you're perverting justice and judgment, well, those are different circumstances. Well, anyway, we're going to stop at this point. This is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.